From Jinden to Tarago, Bungendore to Nelligan, Braidwood FM, your local radio station.
Hi, we're interrupting. This is Rod McClure here with our stalwart station manager, Gordon Waters, and we're here to broadcast the live for your listening pleasure. Christy McBain, our local member for Eden Monaro, and she's going to give a speech and take questions from our local people. It'll be about an hour long, and we hope you find it interesting and informative. And of course, as always, if other political hopefuls out there wish to contact us, we're quite happy to interview them or to attend a public meeting that they might hold. Something to look forward to.
Again, it's nice to be back in Braidwood, and it's always a fantastic turnout in Braidwood. People are always keen and interested to talk about politics, and I know everyone doesn't agree with my politics, but it's great to have political discussion because we need to continue that across Australia. Just because we disagree on some things doesn't mean we shouldn't be voicing our opinions. We actually need to make sure we are doing that. That's how we get to good decision making. Thank you for having me here tonight. I first want to acknowledge the traditional custodians of the lands on where we meet and pay my respect to elders past and present. We are in this weird quasi-election campaign. One hasn't been called yet, but we all know it's coming. And soon you're all going to be inundated with plenty of political advertising, I'm sure. So I wanted to get back out and talk to people about things that really matter to them. So in the 20 months since I've been elected, I've travelled around 90,000 Ks across the electorate. Only 90,000, yeah. Best part about being from a small town is I went to get my car service once and the mechanic said, she needs new tyres and I know she's not going to book it in. So he rang the tyre fitter and the tyre fitter collected it and put the new tyres on it so that we would be safe. One of the biggest issues that people talk to me about all the time is mobile phone and internet connectivity. Regardless of where you live in this electorate, we've all had experiences where we can't access any mobile phone connection, especially on our transport routes, and we've all had major problems with internet connectivity. And I think COVID's really highlighted to a number of people how far behind we are with some infrastructure and services in regional Australia. I have worked pretty hard in pushing my side of politics to make commitments around mobile phone and internet connectivity. So tonight I am here to announce that a Labor government will be committing $1 million to mobile phone black spot upgrades along the Kings Highway, the Monaro Highway and the Snowy Mountains Highway. A $3.5 million commitment for mobile phone black spots on the Princess Highway between Ulladulla and Eden, and a specific commitment of $250,000 in Majors Creek and $500,000 in Carwoola. There are a lot of people who gave their lived experiences and their insights from the Black Summer bushfires in the Royal Commission and the New South Wales Inquiry. Both of those reports highlight the need for better connectivity on our major highways. All of them noted that we rely now pretty heavily on mobile phone and data to get information, especially in times of crisis. So I wouldn't be being true to people in this electorate if I wasn't taking those things seriously and pushing forward commitments to actually deal with those things. So that's what I'm here tonight to announce. So there you go. And I am really happy to open it up to the floor for any questions, because I know that there are always plenty of questions. And the thing we need to do most is make sure that we are asking and answering questions as we come into the election, because I think this election is going to be important for a number of reasons. And I want to make sure that you are getting as much information as possible. So I'm going to hand it over to you guys for any questions you might have. None? Fantastic. Thanks for coming. We'll see you later.
What about if you don't live on those areas you've mentioned?
I'll repeat the question just so the radio has it as well. So the question was, what if you don't live in those areas specifically and you are in areas in between? A lot of our issues come along major transport routes. The topography of some of our land means that we're not going to be able to get everything to everyone, but this is This is a damn sight better than what we currently have. I sent out a survey to people across Eden Monaro, and we had over 1,000 responses for black spots. We've literally mapped them on our electorate map. We've done a ton of work in talking to telcos, talking to the current minister, talking to the shadow minister about the things that we need to make sure that, you know, come the next natural disaster or come, hopefully not, the next COVID lockdown period, we're actually better prepared. So whilst this won't deliver everything to everyone, we are starting to take what we are hearing and turning it into an actual promise to deliver something concrete. So I acknowledge that, you know, we're not going to fix everything first go, but I'm listening, I've listened, and I want to make sure we can deliver this. So the funds will be spent on, and it will be determined with telco providers. There may be small solutions in some areas, so small cell towers. Others might be bigger macro towers. There are a number of areas where repeater stations would be helpful to actually get the signal to go further, but we'll be working with those professionals to make sure that we can extend the money as far as possible and cover as much range as possible. So the question was about representation on local council and it being hard for Braidwood to get a representative up. Look, local council is particularly difficult where you've got, is it 9 or 11 you guys have got now? QPRC, 11. What I would suggest going forward is running perhaps a Braidwood ticket. So don't divide your town and run a Braidwood ticket. That's worked, for example, in Snowy Valleys, which is an amalgamated council where they ran a pretty concerted effort and a Tumba-Rumba ticket, and they have now more representation from that area than the Tumut side. But I am sure that there are plenty of people here who, you know, you guys could probably get together and sort out the best way to go about that in 2024. So the question was around how can we make sure that we are putting pressure on the state and local governments to deal with some of the issues in Braidwood, including poor roads, hospital funding. My level of government obviously isn't directly involved in some of the funding of those, but in Eden Monaro, we only have one highway, which is declared a highway of strategic importance, which is the Barton Highway. I've been talking to so what that means is effectively the federal government gives money to the state government to actually help maintain it. So I have been talking to the current minister, I've been talking to our shadow minister, and I've raised this in Parliament a couple of different times now, is that we really need to have a rethink of how these roads of strategic importance are identified. If you go on any of the major highways across Eden Monaro at the moment, so King's Highway, Monaro Highway, Snowy Mountains Highway, Princess Highway, Barton Highway, you'll find that all of them are in significant need of work. Yes, we have been inundated with a ton of rain, which hasn't helped anyone. But what you will have noticed if you've been travelling them, like I have, is a huge increase in the number of passenger vehicles, a huge increase in the number of trucks and transport vehicles. And then we also have Snowy Hydro 2.0 happening, which means we've got this huge amount of heavy truck and heavy equipment movement happening, which is really, you know, tearing up our roads. So I have been asking for a review of the roads of strategic importance, which means that there would be some ongoing funding for those highways identified. I mean, I'll still continue to push for that as we head into the next parliament as well. There are obviously one-off capital grants available to state governments if they apply for them to assist them. But we need to make sure that we are, you know, it's a concerted effort to push state governments to fund highways. I drove up one Sunday night up Kings Highway. I was staying in Braidwood and doing something in Braidwood really early in the morning. And there were two sedans pulled over with hazard lights on in front of me. And I said to Mel, who was in the car with me, I wonder what's happened to them. And then all of a sudden was this big bang. There was a hole in the road and there was basically no signage. My car's a little bit higher. The two cars had pulled over, obviously, because they'd been impacted somewhat. So there is a real need for the state government to understand how bad the state of our roads are at this point in time. And we can continue to write representation letters to them and ask them to tell us what their maintenance program is and when works are going to take place to make sure that it's communicated with the community, which is the most important thing. And you also have a state election coming up in March 2023. The thing I loved about the last election cycle, everyone else really hated it, but we had a state and federal election which took place 2 months between each other in 2019. And from a local council perspective, my then role, it was great to be able to, you know, harass and pressure for the things that I was after. And this time around, you know, we'll have probably 10 months between a federal and a state election, but it is time for communities to start rallying and getting together and saying this is what we want. That was like all at once.
My question's on aged care, but you omitted to mention Main Road 92.
Nerriga Road, yes.
From the coast up to Nerriga.
Yep.
That was a lot of funding from the Commonwealth went into that.
It's a fair bit more.
that one's nowhere near done, I would say.
Yeah. Frank Egan's my name, and just a little bit of background on the aged care question is, okay, so Jenny is high care dementia, Alzheimer's dementia, and I'm her full-time carer. As we go forward, there's only two options for us. There's residential care for Jen, when I can no longer handle her, and I've been inquiring into that. And apart from the ongoing fees by the residential care places, I need to find $500,000 in a bond. Okay, so the other alternative is I care for her at home for absolutely as long as I can. So we've been approved for a level 3 package. Okay, so that means we don't actually get the money. Mm-hmm. A provider gets the money. And then they dole it out as they see fit. Well, they take anywhere from 14 to 30% off the top package. Their fees on the services that they provide probably means that the person getting the service ends up with about 25% of the money that's given by the federal government. So there's a whole bunch of thieves out there stealing money off the government, right? So if you look at the two different systems, the NDIS and aged care, okay, there's parts of the NDIS which would be really good in the aged care system. And the one of them is the money that in the NDIS goes to the person who is affected. It doesn't go through a middleman. Okay, so that means if you're getting, in our case, $36,000, Jenny gets $36,000 to spend on her care. Okay, so if Labor gets in, what we actually need is for people like us who are in the system, we need a commitment that the aged care system is going to be changed to reflect the best parts of the NDIS.
So that question was about aged care and specifically home care packages. Our budget in reply speech that was given last week, ALBO outlined Labor's plan for aged care. What you may not have heard was, I think it was Monday or Tuesday this week, ALBO was in Brisbane and also outlined outlined our plan for home care packages. One of the biggest issues that we are being told, apart from the fact that I've got a home care package and I can't access a provider or a servicer, is that the administration fees are too high and we actually don't end up with any of the care that is designed for us. So we have said that home care packages and the people that are administering them have to be completely transparent about what the money is being spent on. And it's the same in the aged care system. Money is provided to our aged care providers which should be going towards the care, the health, the well-being of residents in aged care, but there is no transparency in the system and no requirement for them to spend the money that they receive on the welfare of the residents. So the two issues are linked, that there actually has to be transparency in the system and you have to report back to the community on the amount of money you receive and how much is actually allocated to a resident or to the home care package receiver. So those things need to be addressed. We ask people in a whole range of other industries and services to make sure that we can see what's being spent. ASX-listed companies have to report every dollar that of income and expenditure through annual reports. This would be no different if you're receiving taxpayers' funds, and taxpayers should know what's happening with those funds.
Why do we need a middleman in the aged care system and we don't need it in the NDIS?
There's a whole backstory to how we've ended up with a privatised aged care system in the first place. I have my own views on this. It is really difficult in regional Australia for people to make money through aged care. And we actually need to have a hard and serious conversation about how we provide care in regional Australia. To me, it's not acceptable for community members to have to leave the towns that they've lived in their whole life, that they love, that where people know them the best, to access care. We have to come up with a different model of care in regional Australia. I hope that we are in a position to form government in May, because we need to be having serious conversations about structural inequality in our country, and we're not having those. We're talking about, you know, $250 in a budget, which will get spent in 1 week's worth of shopping. So I really hope that this next election is a contest of ideas and a vision for the future of Australia. Because if we're not having those conversations, we're going to end up in this same merry-go-round where people tell us what's happening and we can't actually fix it because we're focused on the short-term problem rather than the long-term vision of this country. I don't have an answer on aged care and whether we can make it an NDIS-type vision, but I'm more than happy to provide that feedback to our shadow ministers and try to get you an answer.
Because it's working quite well for the NDIS. Okay.
There's a lot of participants that don't like it.
but by the same token, the petitioners that are in it are getting the money to spend, and you know, as far as I'm concerned, I'm quite happy to be audited on the spending of funds, as most of carers would be, I suspect. And for those that have you know, that are looking after them, Alzheimer's hasn't got a time span. Jenny could still be here when she's 99 with high care Alzheimer's. She's only 78 now, so, you know, here's the thing, and probably 50, maybe 100% of you will come up with, you will end up with this situation in your life in coming years, where you'll be either looking up, caring for a partner or your parents, and you're going to have to make the same sort of decisions, and that's why, you know, like it's... it'd be really great if you bought the shadow ageing person out here during the election campaign and had another community meeting.
Well, we'll get your details. If you give your details to Mel, we'll definitely come back to you.
Christy, just a question around stepping back to getting prepared for emergencies and that sort of stuff. I sent you an email today, but you probably wouldn't have had time to see it. My name's Mick Peterson. I'm from down in Araluen. Normally we'd have three ways to get in and out of our little valley. At the moment, we've got one. If we were in the same situation that we were in 2 years ago when the bushfires hit, we'd be in a lot of trouble. We'd be in a lot of risk down there. There's a lot of us that live down there. We've got a fire shed that has been promised that we'll get a new fire shed for many years now. The latest information is that sort of put on the back burner because the RFS hasn't got the money. The fire shed we have is not fit for purpose. It's in breach of all sorts of work on safety regulations and practice. So I guess my question is, any ideas how we can sort of maintain the safety of our people in our community when our ability to get out in an emergency is pretty well restricted by one road, which is getting landslips on it and trees falling over it at the moment, and we've got quite a lot of good volunteers down there, members of the community that all get stuck in when there's a fire, but we don't have a shed that's fit for purpose. We can't even go and change into anything and put out a chemical fire on a farm or a house full of asbestos. We've got one toilet and about 20 members.
So the question was around the Araluen area. There's only one road in and out at this point in time because of a whole range of landslips and whatnot, and the RFS shed not being fit for purpose any longer. The RFS do have capital funding. There was $52 million raised by Celeste Barber, which is meant to specifically go to assist RFS brigades. I'm more than happy to take that up with the Emergency Services Minister of New South Wales. We have, as I said, lived through a pretty tough time over the last 3 years. We've had a prolonged drought, black summer bushfires, a whole range of storms and floods which have created havoc right around this place. There is a $4 billion fund, which is an emergency response fund, which is meant to help people in recovery phase, but also help people with mitigation and resilience projects. None of that money's been spent. It's actually earned $836 million in interest, so it now sits at $4.8 billion. December last year, there was a grant fund that was brought out, which was called Preparing Australia's Communities. And I thought, brilliant. They've got it. They're actually going to listen to what we've been saying in our lived experience. These are the things we want to see, you know, prepared for our community better, to mitigate against future natural disasters, to make us more resilient as communities. And you guys, QPRC, were not declared a bushfire priority area. You were not declared a flood priority area. So the six local government areas in Eden Monaro, only two of them were declared bushfire priority, even though we had fires in five. And none of us were declared flood priority areas, even though we'd had floods in all six. Eden Monaro, and this is a horrible statistic, we've had 36 declared natural disasters in the last 5 years. And that's pretty staggering when you think of it, because all of the ones that come to memory are recent. But they're not. You know, we are talking about 36 declared natural disasters in this one area of Australia alone in the last 5 years. That's a staggering statistic. The Labor Party has specifically said that that $4.8 billion fund will be repurposed to deal only with mitigation and resilience measures. We have a whole bunch of other on-budget items that deal specifically with disaster recovery. We actually need to focus on spending money up front to try to keep communities safer and preparing them for, you know, the next event. If we're only ever spending money at the other end of the spectrum, it means we've failed at the start. We really have to prepare for, you know, more frequent and more intense weather events going forward. The latest IPCC report came out on, I think it was Tuesday morning, 1 a.m. You know, it's telling us that things are getting worse much quicker, and we have to be prepared. And that's why that $4.8 billion fund needs to be spent on mitigation and resilience measures. I'm more than happy to follow up with, as I said, the state minister and find out how we can make sure that upgrades are made to the Araluen shed. And if you could provide your details to Mel, we'll come back directly to you. But we need to be doing more in this space. And my biggest gripe is that we've had a lived experience and we need to be listening to the locals on the ground about what we should be doing now, not after the next event. It's just not acceptable to wait till the next event. So the question was, what is holding up the expenditure of the money? Why isn't it happening? And I wish I had an answer. I think I have become the face of bushfire in the parliament. I talk about it pretty frequently. I do so not to score points with people. I do so because we actually need to keep talking about it, because we have people still going through significant trauma and they still need help. I actually had a government minister say to me, with all due respect, Member Frieden Monaro, the bushfires were 18 months ago. I was like, holy cow. You really don't understand your job then. Like this, that's ridiculous. People's trauma doesn't diminish when the fire goes out, and the real task commences once the fire goes out. There are a whole bunch of people here who need significant assistance. We've been asking questions about why no money has been spent, and the answer we keep getting is we've expended other funds, so we don't need to use this one. The last week, a parliamentary sitting week, we were told that a piece of legislation was being rushed through to enable them to expend, I think it was $150 million on a Lismore flood levy and $150 million for the Lismore flood recovery, which I completely agree with. You know how I said preparing Australia's communities before? Great program if they got it right. Lismore wasn't declared a flood priority area. I mean, this was apparently based on climate data and past events. And I put in an FOI request to say, show me the data, show me where it says these are the areas. We had some members of an agency come out and you know, try to work around how they got to these priority areas. Let's just say the question was never answered. Great T-shirt. He's got a Marvel Comics T-shirt on, and I have two boys who are, like, you know, big fans.
I was going to ask about can-do capitalism, but I'll skip it. There's another issue that I am very, 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 very concerned about. We have slowly watched civil rights in this country be circumscribed. Recently, the state parliament passed legislation that essentially means if the minister of the day decides, you can't protest, you can't, because the full force of the law will come against you. Will Labor support a Bill of Rights for Australians which would undo so many injustices because it will apply to all groups, refugees, to Aboriginal people, to all of us? Because at the moment, I'm watching our civil liberties become more circumscribed, all in the name of stopping the boats or national security.
So the question was around civil liberties and a Bill of Rights. The Labor Party will take to the next election one of our core policies is around a referendum to make sure that we enshrine in our constitution an Indigenous voice to Parliament. We haven't spoken about a Bill of Rights yet. I know our colleagues in the ACT have tried that before, a Bill of Rights, but it is, again, something that we haven't discussed as a party as yet, but I'm more than happy to take that away and come back to you.
Most Australians really don't understand that our rights are not guaranteed. They really aren't. Thank you, Christy.
Thank you. And if you could give your details to Mel, I'll come back to you. Poor Mel. At the end of this, she's going to be like, oh, God, Christy, stop saying my name.
I have a concern about the shortage of skilled labour, especially tradies. So out here, we've got an ageing population, a small population of tradies. I don't see these people with apprentices working with them. I just recently went 5 years without hot water in my kitchen because I couldn't get the electricity company to agree with whatever. But the point being that it's so hard to get skilled workers to your place. And with these weather events, and I've been saying for years that I'm going to write an anonymous letter to the CEOs of insurance companies because I don't want to know my house is probably going to fall down. But with the increasing weather events, older people living longer in their homes, they need access ramps, they might need wider doors, they need their bathrooms modified. I'm just wondering, I'm really concerned that in 5 to 10 years' time, I'm actually thinking when I sell my house, I actually don't want to own another property because I just can't see how I'm going to get anyone to come and do maintenance on it.
So the question is about skilled labour, especially tradies in the area. It is. I was about to say, it's not just here, it's everywhere. There's been $1 billion ripped out of the TAFE or vocational training sector. It's pretty bad. I know sort of firsthand about this, so my husband and I run a plumbing business. If we could get more qualified plumbers, we would employ them. We have more work than we can do. Our apprentices have to drive 3 hours to CIT in Canberra and then back. And mature age apprentices, okay, they can probably handle that, but 17, 18, 19-year-old blokes predominantly, sometimes that's a bit dodgy. The Labor Party has confirmed that it would create 465,000 free TAFE courses, places, to start to deal with some of the skills shortages across the country, as well as funding an additional 20,000 university places across the country. I think with COVID, has become really apparent how reliant we were on migrant labour. We are seeing staff shortages across the country in a whole range of sectors because we haven't valued training and skilling up our own people. We actually really need to get back and identify skill shortages and locations to make sure that we are not leaving towns and communities short of what they need to actually survive as communities. There has been a real failure in this, and there's been a failure in the entire apprenticeship scheme. So previously we had apprentices who, when they completed their apprenticeship, would get a lump sum of money from the government. That sum of money was always, it was entitled Tools of the Trade benefit, so that they could actually go out and buy the things they would need to run their own business, or, you know, run a car for another, for the employer. That no longer exists. You can apply for a loan as a fourth-year apprentice just completed, but those incentives no longer exist for the apprentice themselves, and the incentives for employers have continually gone backwards. The system is very complex, doesn't need to be. We really need to have a good hard think about education, both vocational and tertiary education in this country, because we are well and truly short of skills. So the statement was around how we can actually integrate vocational education into our curriculum. Victoria have a fantastic system. I have two nieces who have both finished high school, and they didn't finish high school. They both finished at year 11, both came out with certificate threes, which they were doing as part of their school studies in Victoria. So there's a system in place. It wouldn't be hard for New South Wales to implement a similar or the same system as Victoria. It takes will. There you go.
When you're looking at apprenticeships or traineeships, the wage is significantly lower. And that's why a lot of our young people are choosing not to choose that path, because they can't move out of home and they can't simply afford to live on an apprenticeship wage.
So the question was around wages for apprentices and trainees, especially in first year. They've always been traditionally lower. They're worked out as a percentage of the full qualified rate, which is handed down by Fair Work, and different for different vocations. The wage has gone up significantly from what it used to be, still based on a percentage of the award wage. There are a lot of businesses who have to pay more than the award wage, because if they don't, they don't have access to staff, and the cost of living has gone up markedly. That would be a Fair Work case to change apprentices and trainees' wages.
And her wage is still lower than the poverty line, basically. So I'm not sure if her employer's not passing it on. Or...
You can check on the Fair Work website. You can actually go to it and plug in some details, and it will spit out exactly what the amount is that should be paid to you. Yeah, as a first year, second year, third year, fourth year apprentice. There's also some qualifications. If you finish year 12, it's a little bit higher. If you haven't finished year 12, it's a little bit lower. If you have another skill that you've done, it's a little bit higher. It spits out exactly what you should be paid and some of the allowances that should be paid as well. So please go to the Fair Work website. There's a whole bunch of information on there about it.
Thanks, Laura and Ian from Araluen. Just coming back to the issue of all this money sitting somewhere earning lots of interest. One of the things that's really hard in those small regional communities is how much we rely on volunteers to get access to so much of that money. And over this last couple of years since the fire, I'm sure lots of people in this room have been applying for funds. But the funds have all been directed to the Band-Aid. To the small, how can we make our community a bit more cheerful, how can we make it a bit more connected, and none of it has really been directed to the really big spend, climate change, massive road program around Australia. What is it that you think you're able to bring to the table on that one now?
So that question was around, we've seen some band-aid solutions after the Black Summer bushfires, a lot of small and cheerful projects, but nothing that deals with any of the structural issues. The worst thing that happened after the Black Summer bushfires is competitive grant rounds to actually get your communities back on track. That does nothing except pit communities against each other. We actually require local councils and state governments do a whole range of plans. So my old council did a climate resilience plan, which looked at infrastructure, services, industry, businesses, all of the things that may have an impact with climate change. We were required to do that by the state government. We're required to do flood studies on every estuary and every waterway. We're required to put in place operational and delivery plans by the state government. There are a whole bunch of plans. There's 526 councils across Australia. There are a whole bunch of plans out there that actually the work's already been done. We know the infrastructure that's always hit hardest. At the moment in the federal government, the disaster recovery payments paid to local councils during a natural disaster only allows them to build what was previously there. Doesn't allow you to better it. In fact, if you better it, you're not allowed to access the funds because you're not putting back what the community had. So we really need to have a think about, as I said, there's some hard conversations coming. There are some really difficult structural issues that we need to be talking about. And we as communities have to be prepared for the hard conversations. And I think that's going to be the difference this election period is, you know, hopefully we are not going to see short-term quick fix, I'm trying to win a seat and get in power. Hopefully we are talking about long-term policy, what the vision for the nation is, how we are going to pull our weight in the world on climate change, how we're going to make ourselves resilient to, you know, regional pressures. I mean, right now we sit at the end of a supply chain, which we've all felt, and if we're not addressing some of these issues, then we're really missing the mark. So I really urge everyone, this election shouldn't be about the short term. Really has to be about the long-term issues facing us as a country. And these are the things we need to be tackling. You know, the nice-to-have stuff is great and it does bring community cheer and it does galvanise volunteer groups especially because we're working together on a shared project. But we really need to be thinking about how we make ourselves resilient into the future, what the future of agriculture is going to look like. You know, there is a whole bunch of R&D that needs to be taking place to make sure that we are world leaders in agricultural technology. We need to know that we are growing the right things in the right places given what's going to be happening over the next 20 to 30 years. So this is the time where we need to start having the big conversations, and I really hope that we're up to the challenge on it.
So I just wanted to raise housing as an issue. I mean, I know you're expecting this. I know it's also a nationwide problem, but in our small town, it's absolutely critical. We have people having to leave town who've lived here for a long time. They can't afford the rents. There are not enough houses to buy. There's a lot of pressure coming from different areas on the limited stock of housing in our town. I'm just wondering what the Labor Party's policy is going to be on affordable housing.
So the question is about housing. I don't think I need to say anything else because everyone knows what I'm talking about. The Labor Party announced the $10 billion Future Housing Fund. So we will work with state and territory governments and not-for-profit providers on public housing, social housing and affordable housing. At the moment, there are a bunch of public housing sitting empty because there's minor maintenance works that need to be done. We're actually really quick, easy fixes. Let's get the money out into communities to make sure that those fixes can take place and we can house more people. There are also planning issues that have changed over time. So not everyone needs the, single dwelling, three bedroom, one bathroom on an enormous block of land. There's some pretty quick, easy wins in actually making sure that you build to your capacity so that we can actually house more people on big parcels of land. There are some fantastic affordable housing providers across Edam and Arrow. There's Argyle, there's Southern Cross, Carabar Housing, who do fantastic work and want to do more. They just need the capital injection to get them going. And the other thing we need to do is, too often we hear that housing is a state responsibility. It actually requires three levels of government to make sure that we get this right. A capital injection from the federal government would be welcome, I'm sure, in every state and territory. Every state and territory needs to come together and work with the federal government, and the Labor Party has said we want to put in place a housing and homelessness plan. We actually need to map out where we need housing, why we need it, are we going to need more in a specific location in the future on projected growth. And the third thing is we've got a local council areas who deal with planning. Now, planning is going to have to change over time. We are seeing more and more people who want to go down the path of intergenerational homes, you know, more than one generation in a home, or on a parcel of land. We know that the fastest growing cohort of homelessness is single women over 55. And the people I talk to, they don't want a big dwelling to themselves. They'd love a one-bedroom unit with a little courtyard so the dog can run around still. So we actually have to really start thinking about what type of housing we need, and we have to make sure that our planning laws keep up with what we actually need as communities, because far too often that belief that everyone wants a three-bedroom, one-bathroom dwelling is way out the window. And when we look at some of the demographics of the people needing housing, their needs are vastly different to what we've expected. So we actually need all three levels of government coming together to work on a solution. The Labor Party has committed $10 billion to make sure that we start that conversation. I'm just going to go here first.
Sorry, I'm short, so I'll stand up. I am Teachers Fed representative at Braidwood Central, and I'm here with a few of my colleagues. We've got, I know education has been mentioned a couple of times as maybe a state issue, but we've got some questions about how federal government can help support public education across the country. Firstly, I want to acknowledge that Labor have committed in the budget reply to increase capital funding so that funding for public schools matches that of the semi-independent schools who rely heavily on the government. Government subsidised schools, so-called independent. But in 2010, the Gonski inquiry showed that the schooling resource standard was the number one thing in order to meet student needs. We know, you know, we've heard the impact that the last 3 years has had on the adults in our community, and we know that that impact has been felt by our children as well. And so having proper funding for the SRS, the School Resource Standard, is so important. It means more teachers, improved ratios, it means more support staff. Currently, the way that public schools are funded, 1 in 8 children effectively have no money. They're sitting there for free, all right? So there's no support for those people. So we're here to ask, will Labor commit to fully funding the SRS? Because that's something that 12 years ago the Gonski inquiry found was essential. 12 years later, we're still waiting for that. So
we want to hear from the answer.
Like the teachers. So we have members of. Are you all from Braidwood?
Yeah.
Braidwood Central School. The Teachers Federation, who are asking about Gonski funding. And specifically the school resource. Yeah. I think what the most disappointing thing is for a number of people is that over the last 10 years they've moved away from the Gonski model, which was not the Labor Party. Public education will always be better funded under the Labor Party than it will under the Coalition because we believe in it. The thing that changes people's lives is education, whether that's in schools, in vocational education or in tertiary education. It has the ability to change lives, and it is a great equaliser in society. I don't have a specific answer on the school resource level of funding for you tonight, but I do commit to getting an answer from our shadow, Tanya Plibersek, and coming back to you guys. The last couple of years we've talked about, you know, the heroes of the pandemic over and over and over again. The thing that I realised during the COVID period, and especially during times of lockdown, was how much we rely on teachers. I tried the learning from home thing. I have three kids. Last year they were in grade 6, grade 3 and grade 1. I'm a terrible bloody teacher. So thank you for the work you guys do. Because if my kids had to rely on me for all of the education, not just the this is how family works and these are our values and our morals, then I'm not exactly sure how good they'd be at maths. I think the reading and the writing part I'd have nailed a little bit, but you guys do an absolutely amazing job and we want to make sure that we do support you. I think you guys do an incredible job and I'll be fighting for you guys with Tanya.
Going to make people irate, and this sort of flows back to the TAFE. So again, know that you're planning on funding TAFE places. Obviously staffing schools is not just an issue here, it's an issue nationwide, and that is a state issue, but the training of teachers, university placement and support for university, that's something that the federal government can do something about. And is that something that you're planning on doing? The raise the status and the respect and the appreciation, you know, more than thanks. It's not just about thanks. Yeah. It's about attracting and retaining teachers. Because my boy last year was in year one. I've got a kindergarten kid and a second grader. And I have genuine concerns for who is going to teach my children over the next 15 years. Because where are our new teachers coming from? And what is Labor committed to increasing the status of the profession and supporting university placements for teachers?
So there will be 20,000 additional university places under the Labor Party, and hopefully under a Labor government. We will work heavily with sectors where we have skills shortages. We know teachers and nurses are two critical professions that we actually need to get skilled up and out in the workforce as soon as possible. Someone gave me a stat yesterday. In the 70s, a teacher was paid the same amount as a parliamentary backbencher. And that was the status that they had in communities. At Deb Balls, the debutantes were presented to principals or bank managers, you know, the people that were seen as pillars of society and, you know, the important people in communities. And we have gotten to a stage now where we actually don't value the people that are doing the work that we actually require to make sure that we have educated, informed and cared for citizens going forward. So I look at some of the early childhood educators where my kids went previously to daycare. I look at some of the teachers. My mum worked in aged care for 15 years, and these people are some of the lowest paid people in our society, yet we entrust them with effectively our most prized possessions as parents, as grandparents. So we really need to think about, as I said before, what the vision is for this country, because if we're not serious about that cradle to the grave mentality of making sure that we are an inclusive, informed society, then we've really failed. And over the past 10 years, we have really seen a divide crack open in our societies, and that divide is growing, and we have to find a way to actually bring people back to the middle and understand what we stand for as a country, and what we value the most. And I think we've missed the boat or we've missed the point on it over the last 10 years. And I heard our former state member John Barilaro say on TV the other night, and I was quite shocked but very pleased. Over the last 2 years, we've talked about our most vulnerable people in society. We've talked about protecting those people who were most vulnerable, ageing people, people who had underlying medical condition, and kids. But the government didn't understand or value that in their budget. And as a member of a different political party than me, but John and I get along quite well, he was out on TV saying the Labor Party got it right. Their aged care policy is exactly what we've been talking about over the last 2 years. You put more money into it because you value these people, you value their lives and their contribution to the country, and we should value the people caring for them. It's no different in the education sector. It's no different in the early education sector. And we actually have to start thinking about the things and the people we value the most.
Students leaving school and having to pay a fortune to get out a huge loan to actually pay for an arts education. The ALP policy on arts and entertainment.
So the question was about arts, the arts industry. Who have done and I should also mention that we are in the School of Arts, and there is an exhibition at the back, and you can buy things down the back. So please go and buy something from the arts community, and all over the walls here. Not this, not a work of art. Look, it's incredibly disappointing to see price used as an indication of what we value and what you should train as at university. University is there mainly for, regardless of what you study, is there to actually get people to develop and use critical thinking skills, to actually have an informed opinion, enter into a debate about anything.
And that's where we have to leave tonight's Braidwood community meeting. That was broadcast live from the Braidwood Regional Arts Centre, Waller Street, Braidwood. And you had been listening to Christy McBain, local member for Eden Monaro.
This is Braidwood FM.